Okay, everybody, let's get started. My name is Courtney Darrow, and I will be the acting facilitator for today's webinar. First of all, I'd like to thank all of you for attending, for it's you that makes our work possible. Today's webinar is a great opportunity to share, learn, participate, and ask questions, and get involved. We're excited to share the latest information on clean energy policy, technology, and science with you through our monthly webinar series. Ann Blair, SACE's Clean Diesel Program Manager, will provide an overview of today's webinar. Again, thank you for joining us today, and I will now turn the presentation over to Ann. Ann?
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for joining. Again, I'm Ann Blair, and I'm the Clean Diesel and Bioenergy Program Manager with the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. And I've served that role for the past 8 years at SACE, starting our diesel cleanup initiatives. We work intimately with many partners around the region and nationally, and we're the Southeast lead organization that's part of the National Diesel Cleanup Campaign that's facilitated by the Clean Air Task Force. As most of the work in the diesel campaign has focused on public health impacts, it's become increasingly clear to us the need to reduce diesel in order to help slow global warming. And so I'm really excited for our panelist speakers today. And what I want you to take away from today's webinar is a basic understanding of black carbon and its impact on global warming, the obstacles and opportunities for black carbon reductions, and policies and local initiatives to meet those goals. So today, next slide, please. We're thrilled to have a great panel of speakers, Michael McCracken with the Climate Institute, John Topping with the Climate Institute, as well as Conrad Schneider with the Clean Air Task Force. And then I'll be wrapping up with some of the local Southeast initiatives that we're pursuing, as well as opportunities to get involved. So with that, I'd first like to introduce Dr. Michael McCracken. He's the Chief Scientist for Climate Change Programs with the Climate Institute in Washington, D.C. He is an atmospheric scientist whose research, primarily with the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, included studies regarding the climatic effects of greenhouse gases, volcanic aerosols, and nuclear war, air quality in the San Francisco Bay Area, and acid precipitation in the northeastern U.S. Dr. McCracken is the past president of the International Association of Meteorology and Atmospheric Sciences and served on the synthesis team for the Arctic Climate Impacts Assessment. So welcome, Dr. McCracken. Just hit star six and you can begin the presentation.
And why the new focus on black carbon. So if I can have the next slide. So just to be clear, the climate is changing. There's a lot of indications. So CO2 concentration is still going up significantly. As NOAA has indicated, the temperature is warming. There's been a lot of debate about exactly what's happening. Is the current climate going up? But with year-to-year fluctuations, you get ups and downs. But if you do a decadal average, as the red bars in the lower left show, you get an increasing temperature. There's a little bit of difference in the sort of around 1940s from where you see some high numbers. You think that's sort of sulfate in the middle of the century, but those high numbers during World War II are probably still a bias in the record. But the warming is causing Greenland to lose mass with mountain glaciers and ocean warming and the ice sheets losing mass, sea levels going up. So we really have change going on. The next one, next slide, talks about what or shows a few things from what's happening in the United States. And that's really important to look at. So NOAA recently put out these maps in the upper left that they say are the change in the normal temperature from 1971-2000 to 1981-2010. And the temperatures on the left are for the minimums and the temperatures on the right for the maximums. And you see from the color bars that they go up to about a degree Fahrenheit. These are very nice plots, but it sort of gives you a sense that the temperature's only warmed a degree over this period. When actually, if you think about how this is put together of the average of decades, this is the average rate of warming per decade over this period. So the warming over this period is actually three times the number. So from the 1970s
Mr. McCracken, I need to interrupt you just a moment. There's some crackling coming in on your line. Started as soon as you spoke. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Could you call out of the number really quick and then call back in, and we'll resume the webinar that way? And when you call back in, at that point, you'll hit the feature we spoke about. Thank you.
Okay, or maybe is it happening now?
It is.
All we need you to do is just put the phone a little bit closer to your face, and I think that'll
Let me try it this way. Okay. So in the lower right, what you see is that the projection is for further drying across.
No, I'm sorry. The audio is still very crackling.
Okay,
is there
I'll call
another phone nearby?
I'll call it back in.
Yeah, you don't need to do anything. Just call back in. It'll just be a moment.
If you can't fix it, it's crackly but still audible. We can still hear what the doctor's saying.
Okay, this is Mike, and I'm back
Thank
in.
You. That's perfect. Thank you so much.
Okay, all right, so let's go to the next slide. So one of the things that we know is, and it's been very clearly established over recent research, is that climate change is due to human activities, and I just want to reemphasize that there's a very clear distinction between what is happening now and what would be happening without the influence of human activities. This chart sort of shows in the black line are sort of the observations on different regions of the world. The blue is what happens if it were just solar variations and volcanic eruptions occurring. That's sort of what the model projects would happen. And then the pink band is what would be expected with human activities. And you see there's good agreement on basically all the continents. The only place there's actually disagreement, interestingly, is if you look in the lower right corner, is over the oceans during World War II. And as I said, that's a time when there's still concern about whether those measurements were actually made properly or whether there's biases in the measurements due to some things that happened during World War II when the measurements were being taken. If we go on to the next slide, we can sort of get a sense about what lies ahead. So if we want to understand what the further warming influences in the future is going to be, this is an attempt to represent that. So the vertical axis is the warming influence, called radiative forcing in scientific terms. And if we start with a blue curve at the bottom, that's what is a result of 20th century emissions of greenhouse gases. And if you were to have stopped emissions in the year, roughly the year 2000, and sort of assumed everything else went to zero, forget sulfate aerosols for a moment, but if you let everything else go to zero, that would sort of be the remaining warming influence of the CO2 and the other gases. Most of the other gases go away quickly. And then what you see in the other colors are what are the impacts from the 21st century emissions. So the red is what happens from CO2, 21st century emissions of CO2. It basically takes a while to build up its influence because it has a long lifetime, so it sort of slowly builds up to its maximum. Then you see methane, which has a short lifetime, builds up to its sort of full effect pretty quickly. Similarly with ozone, and then there's some trace gases. And then we sort of added black carbon on here. I didn't have it sort of go away and reappear in the 20th century, but that's sort of the estimated black carbon influence. So if you sort of, the volume or the area of these amounts is sort of the equivalent, a measure of the 21st century warming influence. And what's very interesting is that, just taking the gases for a moment, the area of the CO2 curve and the area of the ozone and methane curves are roughly the same, meaning that the warming influence during the 21st century from emissions during the 21st century is going to be about half due to CO2 and about half due to these other gases. And then black carbon is also it's going to have its influence also very rapidly because it doesn't carry over. Now, this doesn't mean that CO2 isn't important to do because CO2 has a very long lifetime, and so it persists for a long time and will stay up at a high level. But it does mean if you want to have an effect early on to reduce the warming influence, you want to reduce black carbon, tropospheric ozone, and methane. So if you go to the next slide, there's sort of a table that gives a sense of what the relative influences are and what the potential is. So if you divide up what's contributing to the warming influence, the first row is the carryover from the 20th century. There's not much we can do about that. We're sort of stuck with it unless we figure out ways to scrub CO2 out of the atmosphere, which is pretty expensive to do. The second part is the long-lived greenhouse gases we're adding during the 21st century, and they have a really large influence, and you can see it's a large term, and we certainly have to deal with that, but it's really been proving hard to do. We have to get on and aggressively do it as much as we can, but that's going to take a while, and it's hard to have much of an influence before 2050, and the influence grows over time, and when members of Congress sort of say, oh, or the skeptics sort of say, oh, well, I don't have to do it now because it's not going to have much influence in 2050. That's because if you treat everything like CO2 with a long lifetime, the influence comes later. But as you look at the next two rows, those are the short-lived greenhouse gases and absorbing aerosols, the black carbon. And they have a pretty significant influence. There's some uncertainty in those for a lot of reasons. But what's really important to recognize over in the right-hand column is we can do a lot about those quickly with existing technologies. And so it's really important to get at these. And they provide an opportunity for slowing the rate at which we're warming and sort of putting off the ultimate warming, which is determined by the CO2. I should just mention there's also sulfate aerosols at the bottom. As we reduce those, they will cause a warming influence. So as we clean up air pollution is cleaned up, and that's happened a lot in North America and Europe, but as it starts to happen more in China and other places, that's going to actually create a warming influence that would add to the greenhouse gases. That's why it's, again, really important to get rid of and reduce emissions of the short-lived greenhouse gases and absorbing aerosols, because you don't want that warming influence to have an effect as well. So the next slide basically is just the cover of a report that's tried to put all of this together. It's been done by the United Nations Environment Program and the World Meteorological Organization. And this is sort of the summary of it. It's readily available on the web, and a pointer can be provided to it. And then the next figure sort of gives a key result from this new international assessment that was done, which is what you can do about the warming influence by cutting emissions of various kinds. So let's see if we get to the next slide. Here we go. Okay, so the black line is the observed warming. In the background are this salmon color and yellow color are the potential warmings that the leaders of the world are saying they want to avoid. They've basically come to the conclusion or agreement they don't want to exceed 2 degrees over pre-industrial warming because at that point we might have dangerous impacts. Many scientists would say we already have pretty significant impacts if you're in the Arctic or you look at what's happened to Greenland and Antarctica, so we'd like a lower number, and we're only at 0.8 now, so we'd like a lower number. But in any case, those are sort of the background numbers. If you look at the green line called reference, that's sort of what happens if we don't do anything. It's one projection of emissions into the future and the warming, and you can see that by the late 21st century, we're getting up to 2 or 3 degrees warming, well into the dangerous range. If you look at what focus on just CO2, which is sort of that maroon line that tilts over, that assumes you start emissions controls in the near future, but you can see it doesn't really start to have much influence until 2050 or thereafter.
which is sort of the point that sometimes the skeptics, as I said, are making. If you look at the blue curve, however, that's what happens if you just go after the methane and black carbon measures that they talked about in this report. And you can see that pretty early on you have an effect, and that effect is about a half a degree reduction below that top curve. And if you do both the CO2 and the methane and black carbon, you continue to curve that over and actually end up headed towards staying below the 2 degrees warming. And you actually, if you sort of do the calculation, you basically cut the warming that we'll experience between now and 2050 about in half. And this is with just sort of 15 general measures they have that you can read in the report. The next page sort of highlights a few of what those are to give you a sense of those. I guess the next one is actually sort of where they're all coming from, and we can then go on to what the next one is. But these curves give a sense of where the black carbon part of all of this is coming from, which is what we're really after. The upper left is for the global sources. A lot of that is open burning, but open burning, it's hard to control, but it also comes out with white elements of aerosol, so it sort of has a little more mixed effect. But you can see transport is sort of growing toward a quarter of the total emissions. There's a lot of residential there because there's a lot of wood burning and inefficient stoves there. So bottom left is North America. There's, we provide about almost 10% of the total emissions. We're only about 4 or 5% of the population, so our per capita black carbon emissions are higher than the global average, which is means it's important for us to do this as well. About half of that is coming for transportation, and we'll be talking mainly about that from diesel. There's some from residential. There's some open burning. That's mainly Canadian forests and other things that are occurring. If you look at the upper right, that sort of gets, again, a spread of where things are coming from. So there are some other areas of the world to be working on. And the bottom right sort of gives the time history in the U.S. for the fossil fuel component of where this is coming from. And you can see as you get toward the present, it's a little hard to read the years on there, but as you get toward the present, it's almost all from the transportation sector. So the next slide just gives a few of the areas and things that we can work on. There's a lot that we can do to reduce mobile source emissions. And we'll be talking about that. It's certainly part of it is getting the new vehicles that are made to not put out black carbon, but part of it is a retrofit, which is relatively inexpensive. There are things to go after point sources of various kinds, utilities and boilers and stuff that is still putting out black carbon. You can do some with the biomass if we can actually harvest it and either, plow it into the ground is one approach. There are some reasons people burn crop residue because of pests. But if you can burn it or if you can make it into biofuel in some way. And there's a lot, at least around the world, we can do to reduce inefficient combustion in homes, particularly those in rural areas. So with that, I think I'll pass it back.
Okay, well, our next presenter is John Topping.
I'm available.
CEO. Okay. Well, I will turn the mic over to Ann then.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Sorry, I did start speaking. Our next speaker is John Topping. He's the founder and president of the Climate Institute in Washington, D.C., since its founding in 1996. From 1989 to 1990, he served as editor of the portions of the IPCC First Assessment Report concerning impacts of climate change on human settlement, industry, transport, energy, human health, and air quality, and on impacts of climate and UV interactions. Topping received a certificate from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change for contributing to the award of the Nobel Peace Prize of 2007 to the IPCC. He holds a BA from Dartmouth College and a JD from Yale University. So, Mr. Topping.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, okay, great, great. First, you know, if you can go on to the second slide after the cover slide, and I think that illustrates the importance of the alliance that has been set up between Clean Air Task Force and SACE, that a practical problem, if we're really going to take advantage of the opportunities that Mike McCracken has described, is, you know, this is an opportunity to move things globally, but there is a kind of natural backlash and resistance in a lot of the developing countries that, look, you folks in the countries of the North or the rich countries have not done nearly enough on CO2, and now you're suddenly coming to us and picking on us and so forth on this. And I think that underscores the importance of really moving simultaneously in two directions in this issue. One is with initiatives such as the Clean Diesel initiative that is underway here in the U.S., you know, that will essentially be dealing with retrofits. You know, we have much tougher standards that are already taking effect in the major industrial countries for the new vehicles. And, you know, this initiative will be described by Conrad, you know, shortly. You know, that is a way of sending a signal that we're not just picking others. We're, you know, we're pulling the oar ourselves. We've also ourselves at the Climatist have been working to create a kind of international Black Carbon Reduction Council. And we have a few groups, the Energy Foundation of Pakistan, the Insight Engineering that built the Malaysian embassy, and the latest addition of the Chinese embassy, Rotec Diesel, an Australian firm that is doing a major retrofit in right now in Manila that I'll describe, and also World Preservation Foundation in the United Kingdom that has been focusing very much on agricultural related emissions and emissions related to land use conversion. So, you know, there are efforts to try to get this going internationally, but what we need to do is really underscore as much as possible win-win aspects. That is, that there are very strong human health benefits, and in many cases, other kinds of aspects. SACE, for example, has been very active within the southeastern United States in opening up opportunities for use of industrial energy recycling. It's a very inexpensive form of electricity that, in effect, is zero carbon by harvesting waste heat for energy. You know, this is probably is not only a major means of reducing CO2, but it's also it also creates some additional benefits in particulate reduction. Now, not nearly as much, of course, in the richer countries where we have strong particulate standards. But if you were to go to China or you go to, you know, countries in Asia, you would end up getting from enhanced use of industrial energy recycling, you'd get essentially a very large additional particulate reduction benefit that in some ways in terms of its effect in climate forcing might be even larger. So even this initiative itself is of some real significance in the U.S. I think that also I'll be discussing the effects of black carbon on the polar regions, where not only is this contributing globally to the warming, as Mike has described, but within the Arctic, there's a kind of enhanced a change in albedo, essentially changing the reflectivity of sea ice and glaciers, speeding the melting that is going on there, that is of great significance. Now, those effects in the Arctic are coming very largely from Scandinavia, some burning, within Canada, Kazakhstan, Russia, etc. Generally among the richer countries there, and action is underway right now within the Arctic Council to try to address some of these concerns. We're finding within the Antarctic Peninsula there are real problems associated with black carbon that in a conference that I attended in London in November, essentially, were attributed to a substantial extent by one of the Brazilian presenters to emissions coming out of the Amazon and also coming out of Africa. So, you know, in this case, you know, the effects from, you know, much from the south were related to, you know, to the effects in the Antarctic. But again, this underscores the need to get everyone pulling together and not, you know, pointing fingers and saying you go first. I mean, and the nice thing about the black carbon reduction efforts that we were all involved in is that they do have a lot of win-win aspects, including a lot of saved lives, particularly of women and kids. Next slide, please. Hello. Yeah, here we are. And this, as I was indicating, the effects are really sizable within polar regions, and again, activity across the board on a variety of areas is crucially important. The next slide. A huge problem that we face at this point is the lack of valuation for black carbon reduction. I think that those of us who've looked closely at this issue over the last 3 years, particularly after Mike McCracken did an article in June of 2008 that really shifted a lot of the international focus to this, recognize this is probably the most important single thing we could do in the near term, but we have really a crazy situation under the incentive systems that are set up internationally, under the valuation systems, the CDM, the various Kyoto systems, and so forth. There is effectively a zero value from a climate standpoint to reductions of black carbon, even though they're what can make the biggest difference, and that is a very major impediment to this. So while actions are happening in a lot of instances under individual mandates within countries that are related to largely to air pollution concerns, but also recently have been reinforced because of the recognition there's a climate nexus, there's not nearly the incentive system that would be possible. Now, what's very interesting right here, you'll see these very colorful jeepneys in Manila. The jeepneys are a huge source of pollution, and unlike cook stove users, where the Shell Foundation has done of cook stove users, even though the World Health Organization data suggests that we have about 1.8 million deaths annually worldwide. The vast majority of women and children associated with cook stoves, only about 1 in 10 of the cook stove users believe she's at risk. Mama and grandma always did this. It must be okay. Well, in the case of the Philippines, on the other hand, the jeepney drivers recognize there's a huge problem. They die a lot faster than the population in general, and the Jeepney Drivers Association has really gotten very active on this. And an Australian firm, Rotec, has developed a kind of ingenious approach with some funding from a voluntary emission reduction credit fund that will happen over a period of about 3 years. There'll be about 500,000 jeepneys that will be retrofitted. The jeepneys will have a installation cost of about $600 each. Technically, they're being rented. It's for a peppercorn cost, roughly about 1 peso a year, or roughly about 2 cents a year. So the Rotec essentially will get its money back over about 3 years, and of course and will continue to by about the fourth year presumably be ahead of the game. And this is a very effective means of allowing the drivers at effectively no cost to themselves to extend their life expectancy and that of their passengers and that of others around. There's likely to be somewhere in the neighborhood of about an 80% reduction in the particulate because of the particular devices that are being used here, and about a 5% increase in fuel efficiency. So there's a marginal kind of economic advantage. But in this case, there's a huge health advantage that is actually driving them. This is a very interesting experiment, and if the same thing can be adapted for cook stoves and other other approaches, this will provide a major incentive. Also, in the United States, there is a and we're involved very much in this, an ANSI standard, a greenhouse life cycle assessment standard, is being developed here, which ultimately could shape an ISO, a kind of international standard, that would have major effect on large-scale projects, would be seeking this kind of, good housekeeping seal of approval and so forth that's associated with that. And this standard right now is looking at creating a valuation for black carbon and for tropospheric ozone, and moving from the 100-year valuation, which is really also greatly undervalued methane, to something much shorter term. And, the combination of the use of voluntary emission reduction credits in the very near term, following on the example in Manila, together with this developing ANSI standard, is a means of creating a real valuation. And then finally, the last slide really goes into one of the problems of that I mentioned really earlier here. Win-win approaches are crucial to the success of this, because you find even in the U.S. Congress, some who have been fairly skeptical about climate change, can recognize that there's a real importance in moving on reducing particulate emissions. They breathe air just as all the rest of us do. So even here, that is a substantial advantage. But I think that you have with black carbon, you have a very differential situation. In Manila, for example, where there is an overwhelming perception among the population that the air pollution associated particularly with transportation is a huge problem, there's not a major problem in risk communication. On the other hand, in a lot of rural areas with cook stoves, there is that. So the strategies to address this may have to be fairly ingenious, persuading the lead woman in the village to move on this, creating kind of economic incentive if there's a total transformation in the village to cleaner cook stoves. Perhaps the money goes in to build a well or some kind of village project, any of a number of things. And I think a lot of these are going to vary very much, given different cultures. But what we have in this whole issue involving black carbon is the need to get action globally, trying as much as we can to build on the combination of immediate health gains and effects on climate. And we also have to recognize that while the emissions of black carbon are only up in the atmosphere typically for a week or two, they're constantly recharged. They're essentially chronic emissions. If you don't change the cook stove practices, you don't change the diesel practices, you don't change the practices in burning, they're going to be replenished, so that you have the ability to make a very big difference quickly in this. And if you can build on the win-win aspects of this, particularly health, you can bring a lot of folks to the table who may be a little bit skeptical still on climate change, but they're really concerned about their families breathing and so forth. And I think the initiative that your two organizations, Clean Air Task Force and SACE, are involved in is absolutely crucial, not only in saving lives here in the United States, but in really sending a message to others abroad that we really are doing something on this issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Topping. The next speaker is Conrad Schneider, He's the advocacy director of the Clean Air Task Force. He has more than 15 years' experience fighting air pollution and climate change. He directs Clean Air Task Force's advocacy efforts, writes and speaks on air pollution and climate change issues, and testifies before Congress and state legislatures and in the federal and state administrative hearings. Prior to his work with Clean Air Task Force, he worked for the Natural Resources Council of Maine, and he holds a JD from the University of Virginia and a BA from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Welcome, Conrad.
Thanks, Ann. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. Okay, if we could begin the slide presentation. My name is Conrad Schneider. I'm the Advocacy Director of Clean Air Task Force, and I'm very glad to be with you all today. Our organization is a national and international organization. We were founded back in 1996. Our headquarters is in Boston, but we have offices in the Southeast, in the Midwest. We have an office now in Beijing, China. And all of this is aimed at trying to restore healthy air and protecting the atmosphere through scientific research, public education, legal advocacy. Our staff and our consultants include scientists, they include people with business backgrounds, include lawyers, and all kinds of advocates. So that's just a little bit of background about us, if you could go to the next slide. And in our the way we sort of look at our advocacy efforts is that we try to partner with a lot of people at all different levels, as has been referenced in some of the previous presentations. You know, there are a lot of opportunities to do things on black carbon, and I'm going to really focus this conversation on diesel and our U.S. efforts, but I did want to put up this graphic just to show that we're working at the local level with partners. We're working at the state and regional level, and SACE is our sort of lead Southeast partner on this, but we have others in other states and other regions. We work at the federal level all together, so that these sort of overlapping circles in the Venn diagram sort of add to the support for our federal efforts. And as Mr. Topping just described, all together this hopefully creates evidence and some momentum for international action too, where we coordinate our efforts on some specific things, whether it's about the Arctic or about shipping or what have you. Can you go to the next slide? So I'm just introducing here the idea that what we have is what we call the National Diesel Cleanup Campaign. And in the U.S., what you're seeing is our lead partner groups for each region, SACE being our lead in the Southeast. The idea here is to try to cover as many states and localities as possible for their own sake. And what you see here represents states that represent about 50% of the diesel emissions in the U.S. and 70% of the diesel-related premature deaths. But it's also to demonstrate, in addition to passing state laws and local ordinances and so forth to clean up diesel, it's also to demonstrate at the federal level that there's broad geographic and political support for this. And we, at this point, our coalition reaches into all 50 states. Next. So why did the Clean Air Task Force decide to work on this issue? Well, we first came to it as a result of the concerns around public health. And, we were founded working on the issue of cleaning up coal-fired power plants, but as we began to be more successful at that and understand the particulate matter related health impacts from diesels, we in the early 2000s added a diesel campaign to our efforts. And one of the things we were able to do, both for power plants and for diesels, was to estimate the number of premature deaths from each source of particulates over time. And the number for power plant emissions over the course of our campaign has gone to about 50% of what it was, leaving diesel exhaust as being the number one sort of environmental cause of premature death. And it's greater, as you see here from this slide, than many other commonly understood causes of death that we, invest a lot of money and a lot of political capital in trying to solve. Could you go to the next slide? So So, but as we began to move through our campaign, we became aware of the science that Dr. McCracken described earlier in this webinar, and felt that it was an important component to the campaign to explain to people that there's not just a public health reason to do this, but a very great opportunity to have an immediate benefit with respect to combating global warming. And, you know, we know now that as a warming pollutant, black carbon is about 2,000 times more potent than an equivalent amount of carbon dioxide over, if you look at it over a 20-year period. And, you know, it may be, as one of the earlier slides suggested, one of the largest warming agents in the 20th century. You know, we looked at, you know, where we could really provide, you know, the most value added, and it turned out that diesels are the biggest source of black carbon in the U.S. We already had a diesel campaign going on, but this really added a little impetus to it, justification for it. We felt we were able to potentially reach out to other audiences and people who cared about climate and to really be able to explain the diesel issue as a climate issue as well. The other thing is I'm not going to touch – we do work on international issues as well and non-diesel black carbon cleanup as well, but there probably is no more sure thing in terms of making reductions and seeing black carbon climate benefits than working on diesel. Could you go to the next slide, please? So I'm going to focus here on what you can do about diesel black carbon in two ways. First of all, just physically, what are the ways to reduce the emissions? And then really what we're focused on at the federal level in terms of cleanup efforts. And this sort of all comes back to what is the most effective strategy that we can adopt? And what we know is that while there are several different solutions to cleaning up black carbon from diesel trucks or construction equipment or what have you, the sort of the gold standard is a diesel particulate filter, which is the only retrofit technology that can virtually eliminate black carbon particles. It's been verified at an 85% plus effectiveness for particulate matter, but for greater than 90% effectiveness with respect to black carbon, and we've seen this time again in many of the tests that we've done. It's one of the few actions, as was described earlier, that can really have immediate climate benefits, but I want to add that it's no substitute for working to reduce CO2 emissions. It's going to take both over the long haul to be able to get this done. We've done some calculations. The California Air Resources Board has done some calculations too. And you know, just to give a sort of a common sense notion of what kind of climate benefit really is packed into diesel emission reductions, simply retrofitting a fleet of about 1 million long haul trucks with diesel particulate filters would have the climate benefit equivalent of eliminating the emissions of 11 million cars. So we're talking about something here that's effective and that can deliver significant benefits. Next, please. Okay, so this is just this pie chart is to sort of reinforce the point I made earlier about why we're focused here. This is an EPA chart from one of their reports, and don't be thrown off by the fact that it says EC emissions. That means elemental carbon, and that's very much the same thing as black carbon. It's just a different mode of terminology. But you'll see here from this pie chart that the greatest slice of the pie comes from mobile sources, and almost all of that is coming from diesels. Next, please. So that's why we focus on diesels. And, you know, there are a variety of solutions. I'm highlighting today the diesel particulate filter, but there are a variety of solutions that can help with this problem. You know, the first is, you know, turn off the engine. It's, you know, anti-idling, you know, can through just practices of literally turning off an engine when it's not necessary, or, you know, finding alternatives for engines that need to run for a long period of time, like auxiliary power units in long-haul trucks, start and stop technology on construction sites and so forth. These all can help reduce pollution and save fuel. The second using is basically making sure we're using the cleanest engines available. Simply repowering older engines to, you know, the highest emissions tier that EPA and CARB recognize can significantly reduce can reduce this pollution, maybe by up to half, and that's a worthwhile effort. It improves fuel economy, but also reduces black carbon emissions. And then lastly, if we're talking about installing retrofit controls, or even new engines having to make sure that they have these diesel particulate filters, EPA has done a good job of setting standards for emission standards for new diesel vehicles, both on road a few years ago, and then now just starting to phase in for construction equipment over the next few years. But the problem is we have so many diesel vehicles, and they're so durable that they really need to be addressed, and probably the best way to do that is through repowering and retrofit, and the best retrofit control, as I mentioned, is a diesel particulate filter. So let me focus on the retrofits for just a second. Please move on to the next slide. Okay, so one pretty common retrofit control is a diesel oxidation catalyst. And my message to you today is, as you're working, you know, hopefully become active in working on the diesel issue and in demanding, policy reforms that would mean more diesel retrofits on the existing fleet, is that diesel oxidation catalyst may be a technology that you encounter. And it's not that it's a bad thing, but the fact of the matter is it does not remove black carbon, which is what we're talking about here. It does reduce particulate matter about a quarter or 25%, but because of the physical way in which a diesel oxidation catalyst works, it really cannot capture the black carbon because it cannot physically capture the particles. There are some benefits, and they're detailed on this slide, but if your goal is to reduce black carbon, and I think that's what we're talking about today, this one won't do it. Please move on to the next slide. By contrast, a diesel particulate filter is as much as 98% effective in removing black carbon. As I said, certified at 85% for PM mass reduction, but in a typical cycle, we're seeing almost virtual, what I would describe as virtual elimination of black carbon particles as part of the function of a DPF. Now, to be fair, diesel particulate filters won't necessarily fit on every single application or every engine, some of that can be dealt with by pairing it with a repower or rebuild. Engines don't have a hot enough duty cycle to be able to effectively use a diesel particulate filter unless you spend more money and get what's called an active filter. Those active filters can work on practically everything, but the less expensive ones, which are called passive ones, which are in the sort of $6,000 to $10,000 range per unit, need a certain heat profile to work. And if that's something that crops up in your advocacy or something that you're working on, we can provide a lot of technical information about what engines will and won't take a diesel particulate filter. But our policy preference is to push diesel particulate filters on as many engines as can feasibly take them, because of this point that I'm making, that they're very effective. They virtually eliminate black carbon, and I think you can see why in the next slide. This is the innards of a diesel particulate filter. It's a honeycomb filter. This is a ceramic filter that physically traps the particles that are flowing through it. And both earlier and later in the process, there are other gases and so forth that are controlled and destroyed by a diesel particulate filter. But the key piece with respect to black carbon is that these filters literally trap the black carbon particles, and that's why they're so effective. Next. So we've done some tests to try to be able to demonstrate and confirm the effectiveness of different pollution controls, and I'll only just touch on a few here. This shows the instrument array that we use to literally chase behind diesel trucks and other equipment. There is a on the left-hand side of the slide, what you see is the monitors that register the levels of particulate matter, ultrafine particles, and then there's one that's not shown that actually measures the black carbon. What we typically do is put these in a minivan or a vehicle, and we follow behind. You can see on the right picture on the right, like here is a box truck. We're following behind the truck, and typically what we try to do is sort of monitor the levels of particulate matter before and after the installation of a diesel particulate filter or other device. What you see there is actually a video camera that's mounted on the dashboard of the vehicle, and we videotape this and we overlay the results on top of the video so you can actually see in real time. And if you go to the website that's linked there at the bottom of the slide on our website, you can watch the videos, and it's a number of different types of diesel applications. Next, please. For example, here is a test that we did down in Georgia on school buses, one of the first set of engines that we worked on. And on the left, you see, I think these are actually two different buses as opposed to a retrofitted bus, but one is a conventional bus without a diesel particulate filter, and what you're seeing is the ultrafine particles in the magenta line as we're following the bus, and then a bus that has a diesel particulate filter, the particles are virtually gone. Next, please. And the same is true for construction equipment. This is a wheel loader, a Caterpillar piece of equipment, with and without a diesel particulate filter. On the left, you see that when it drives by the monitor, the pollution spikes, but DPF-equipped wheel loader, once again, virtually no pollution is registered by the monitor. So it's we can see here it's very, very effective. This is the metric here is particle number. Next, please. So this is a pie chart that shows the mobile diesel PM2.5 inventory for the U.S., and I offer this to set up the next couple of slides that we're going to talk about is what are we working on at the federal level. And so if you looked at this pie, and as we did, we sort of said, well, it looks like highway diesel and non-road construction are the two biggest targets in terms of engines that we really need to work on for retrofits. So that's we sort of followed this inventory to decide what policies we would pursue, which you'll see on the next slide. So our focus right now is on really two major objectives at the federal level. The first one, I'll describe both of them briefly and then describe them a little bit more in depth. The first one is a clean construction provision in the new transportation reauthorization bill. This is focused on primarily on off-road construction equipment, that slice of the pie that you saw in the previous pie chart. It involves some on-road, dump trucks, cement mixer, and so forth, but most of it is focused on the off-road equipment. And then the second policy is the Diesel Emission Reduction Act, or DERA, which is a funding mechanism. It's been going on for the last 5 years. It was part of the Recovery Act in 2008, and we've gotten it reauthorized and are now fighting for funding for it. But this is a grant, rebate, and loan program that can help retrofit all types of diesel engines, but the focus has been on the on-road or highway portion, which is the largest slice of the pie that you just saw. So what we're working on right now with respect to clean construction and the transportation bill, that those bills, one in the House and one in the Senate, are moving forward. Well, there's going to be a hearing, there's a hearing going on today in the Senate Environment Public Works Committee on the transportation bill. And we've been working to try to make sure that a clean construction provision was part of that. And likewise, there's a bill moving from the Transportation Infrastructure Committee in the House, and we've been working with the leadership and rank and file members of the House to be able to include clean construction in that. And what we mean by clean construction is a requirement and funding that when you're, you know, building a highway or other transportation project with federal money in a particulate matter non-attainment or maintenance area, that it be that those pieces of equipment be required to have the best available control technology. And that typically would mean either a direct application of a diesel particulate filter or some type of rebuild or repower that could then potentially lead to a filter, or if it's not possible physically to put a filter on that piece of equipment, the rebuild or repower can deliver some pretty major black carbon reductions. And the DERA program, or Diesel Emission Reduction Act program, as I said, it was reauthorized during the lame duck session a couple of years ago, and now we're in the middle of a fight to fund it. As you know, the word of the day on Capitol Hill right now is deficit reduction and debt reduction and so forth. So fighting about money is one of the most difficult things you can possibly do in the for the federal government right now, and we're trying to hang on to some funding for DERA. It's been an extremely effective and cost-effective program, retrofitting literally tens of thousands of diesel engines during the course of its existence over the last 6 years. During, as I mentioned, in the Recovery Act was the sort of high water mark, but at this point there's, I think, been, between half and three quarters of $1 billion has been appropriated to this, and we're trying to get at least some money appropriated to it now. So these are two opportunities for advocacy, letting members of Congress and your senators know that you support clean construction in the transportation bill and that you support funding in the current fiscal year budget for the Diesel Emission Reduction Act are probably the two most effective things you could do in terms of advocating for the reduction of black carbon at the federal level. Now, just leave it on this slide for a second. I do want to mention one other thing, given the Dr. McCracken and Mr. Topping's comments. The one other federal action that you might want to be aware of is that Congress, a couple of years ago, as part of EPA's budget, ordered or required EPA to produce a study on black carbon sources, controls, and even to look at the metrics by which black carbon benefits could be compared to carbon dioxide benefits and so forth. And that study was due by now, or due, I think, next month, but it's not going to come out next month. It's probably going to come out in the fall. It's a little late, but I think it'll be, hopefully it'll be a worthy addition to our understanding of black carbon, and it'll put US EPA officially on the record with respect to sort of its views about a lot of the different scientific and emission control issues related to black carbon. So that's not something I think you can necessarily influence at this point, but it's something to be on the lookout for, and we're certainly going to publicize it when it comes out. Next, please. Okay, so in closing, let me just leave you with, I think people will have access to this these slides later. These are just some links on our website and others, EPA's website, to information about diesel, both the exposures and the climate impacts. And this is my contact information should you have questions you think of after the Q&A session today. But after the presentations are over, I look forward to your questions. Thanks very much, and Anne, back to you.
Great. Thank you, Conrad. Appreciate those great comments. To continue on the same track, following up on Conrad on actions and initiatives, certainly want to state the current pressing issues with the Clean Construction Act of 2011, as well as the Diesel Emissions Reduction Act. Those are going to be very important policies that I think that we need to pass in order to have broad impact across the Southeast region. In the Southeast, the primary initiatives for reducing diesel emissions has relied significantly on funding through the Diesel Emissions Reduction Act, as well as through one other program, the Congestion Mitigation and Air Quality Program. Unlike other areas of the country, North Carolina is the only state that has put forward their own funding and initiatives to reduce diesel emissions aggressively. Southern Alliance for Clean Energy was able to get a one-time pot of money to support some of the congestion mitigation and air quality funding for retrofitting school buses a few years ago. But with that exception, we've relied very heavily on those pots of money. And in order to really aggressively get at these larger sources of diesel emissions construction equipment, we need policies. So I want to share with you a few examples of things going on in other areas of the country. There has been success, and I'm going to focus specifically on clean construction. And again, as Conrad mentioned, that is requiring construction equipment used in projects meet certain emission standards. And so just to highlight a couple of the each different types of clean construction venues that are open for continued work, particularly in the Southeast. So on projects, in Boston, the Big Dig project, the Central Artery project, was the country's first major retrofit construction program. They retrofitted over 200 pieces of equipment for that project. For the World Trade Center cleanup, standards were set by the Federal Transit Administration, and contractors were required to retrofit all diesel-powered equipment with the best available controls. And as a result, 173 pieces of equipment were retrofitted. Next slide, please. Some municipalities have passed ordinances to require clean construction. New York City passed Local Law 77. They were the first to adopt such a policy in 2003, and 430 pieces of construction equipment were retrofitted with best available control technology. Other examples are Chicago, Pittsburgh, San Francisco, and Providence, Rhode Island. And there's policies currently under consideration in Boston and Portland as well. And there possibly could be others, but those were a few I wanted to highlight. The other opportunity is through state. Next slide, please. It's through state law. There's been a few recent successes, so we don't have results yet on what these will achieve. But in April of this year, Republican Governor Christie of New Jersey signed an executive order to clean up construction equipment used in major transportation projects and those that are being funded with funding from the state. 10, Illinois Governor Quinn issued an executive order requiring clean construction equipment on state-funded road construction projects, specifically for non-attainment areas. New York, California, and Rhode Island have also enacted similar legislation. Next slide, please. Another opportunity is working directly with hospitals and universities. A few examples, the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute adopted a policy requiring contractors to retrofit their equipment with controls when they were doing an expansion project there, as well as University of Pittsburgh Medical Center and Harvard University. So those are other big opportunities, and I believe there's some work going on in Charlotte in this arena that June Blotnick has been involved in, and hopefully we might see some success in that in the near term. Next slide. Finally, State Department of Transportation regulations. This is another venue in which these policies can have a significant impact. Illinois, Connecticut, Massachusetts, New York, and Oregon have all passed requirements through their DOT regulations to require clean construction in their projects. Slide, please. How much does this cost? That's one of the big questions whenever we're talking, at the state, the federal level. MJ Bradley and Associates, that Clean Air Task Force works closely with, they evaluated 8 transportation projects cases, and for most of the highway projects, the cost of implementing this, which you would retrofit the equipment, the cost of clean construction would be less than 1.5% of the total project costs. And in some cases, it may approach 2%. But as you see, very low percentage of the overall total project cost for projects to implement these strategies. So we think this is an excellent option to pursue in our region at all the different levels, similar to some of the other state actions. And I ask you to join with me in identifying some of those opportunities. We are currently working with a number of different in all of our southeastern states to evaluate what these opportunities are. Next slide, please. We just have about 15 minutes, so I'm going to make a quick call to action here for ways for you to get involved. Our decision makers clearly need to know the importance of diesel cleanup, both in terms of combating global warming as well as improving public health. So if you're an organization on today and have not signed on to the diesel cleanup campaign platform, I invite you to do so. And the follow-up email to the webinar, I'll have a link to our page where you can sign up for that. Help us solicit businesses, municipalities, and institutions that might be on the cutting edge looking to green their businesses, looking to green their cities. They might be interested in pursuing some of these actions. Also, there's been a number of letters that we've worked to get signatures on promoting clean construction at the local, state, and federal levels, and if you'll join our email list, we'll keep you abreast of those opportunities. And you can contact me directly at my email listed there, ann@cleanenergy.org. So with that, I'm just going to wrap up real quick so that we have plenty of time for questions. But I do want to personally thank you for joining the webinar today. And Courtney, you proceed and open for questions.
Thank you, Ann. What a great presentation. We will now open the session of question and answers. Again, the control panel located on the right-hand side of your screen is how you submit questions. If you have one for a specific panelist, just identify that in your question. The first question is, how about natural gas vehicles replacing diesel vehicles? And that was just open question.
Dan, am I still unmuted?
Yes, you're still unmuted.
Okay, just wanted to check there. Well, I think, you know, in order to reduce overall diesel emissions, we're going to need a diverse range of options for vehicles, both light duty as well as heavy duty. There is, and Conrad may be able to add a little bit more to this, but diesel is a very, very efficient fuel, and I know that historically there's been quite an amount of resistance in terms of shifting to natural gas vehicles over diesels for heavy-duty activities. And I don't know that there are the same applications of natural gas vehicles for diesel vehicle, for switching. But I think just in summary, we're going to need all the tools in the toolbox in order to move and get significant reductions. But Conrad, do you have anything else to add there?
Not really. You know, one of the things when we first started looking into this issue with respect to transit buses and so forth, you've seen probably people have seen compressed natural gas transit buses and so forth. You know, there are a lot of people who were sort of pushing that as a solution. And there's nothing wrong with that, I guess, if you've got plenty of money. I think one of the things we looked at was that you could get, a lot more engines cleaned up through retrofits than you could by purchase of new CNG vehicles. So we were just taking a very straightforward approach, which is, you know, how could you most cost effectively reduce pollution? And that because of the increased expense entailed with CNG. We sort of didn't go that direction, although there have been cities who had enough money to do that. Washington Metro, for example, bought a lot of CNG buses and managed to put diesel particulate filters on all their other buses. So, you know, maybe that was a happy sort of solution for them. But in a time of tight budgets, you know, we just try to push the most cost-effective remedies.
Okay. Next question. This one's for Anne. On added cost for retrofit projects, I assume that once this is done for a vehicle, it does not need to be done again. So spread over several projects, the cost is actually even less. I guess that was more of a statement than a question.
If I understand, this is Conrad, if I understand the question, the answer is yes, particularly on clean construction, once the construction fleet has been cleaned up for this particular project, that would be under the, you know, if the transportation bill includes a clean construction provision and a contractor's fleet is cleaned up, then what's great about that is not only will it be clean on that project, but it'll be clean on subsequent projects.
Wonderful. Right, so the benefits absolutely are going to extend far beyond that single project.
Okay, well then the next question is, was there not a satellite that failed twice to launch to observe black carbon in the atmosphere? Do any of our panelists know about a failed?
Well, it's like, I mean, there have been a couple of satellites fail. One was to measure CO2 in the atmosphere, and I think there was another one that was to measure black carbon. I'm really not quite up on that, but I think there's pretty good satellite observations of, at least for some periods, to show where it's spread. I'd have to look up and follow up with an answer to that one.
Okay.
I mean, what's going to be hard with satellites is that it turns out that all the change has to be is a very small percentage of the amount of solar radiation that's absorbed. And one of the things a number of us are getting so desperate we look at, which is sort of geoengineering or trying to limit the amount of solar radiation coming in, that a CO2 doubling is equivalent to a 2% change in the solar radiation. And so since we're not to a doubling and we're talking about a fraction of it, it's some fraction of a percent change. And given the variability that's occurring underneath on what the reflectivity of the surface is and everything, really becomes hard. You have to do it over sort of pretty standard kinds of albedos and things. So it can be hard to detect, but we sort of know it's there by measuring it and by seeing it get deposited on the snow and other places. So it's there. It's having an effect. And where it's concentrated in some areas, it's having a pretty significant effect.
Thank you so much.
Let me add one thing. My colleague, John Michael Cross, a research director, was pointing out, you know, there was a major satellite crash, right in the Pacific that would have been of some real advantage, and it was a loss which might have helped in this regard. I mean, there is some information available. When you go in, for example, NOAA has the Science of Sphere that we've, the Climate Institute has put in 11 of these in various climate theaters in Mexico, and there are about, 50 others in other places around the world, museums and so forth. They actually have a program which does show black carbon movement around the planet. So, this is extrapolated from, some existing measurement systems and so forth. So there's some evidence. We would have, if we had been a little more successful in this launch, we'd have a slightly better handle on this and so on.
Okay, if there aren't any other responses to that question, we can move on to the next one. Okay, the next question is, what is the difference between particulate matter and black carbon? If a diesel oxidation catalyst can reduce particulates, how can it not reduce black carbon?
Oh, that's a good question. I'll take that one. So particulate matter, diesel particulate matter, is made up of different components, and part of that is sort of organic carbon, and part of it is elemental carbon. And a diesel oxidation catalyst is very good at scrubbing out the organic portion of the particulate pollution, but it doesn't physically trap the elemental carbon particles. So, if as we're on this webinar, we're really focused on black carbon, that's why a diesel particulate filter is so important. The DOC just doesn't physically do that. It will reduce the particle mass because it's reducing the organic carbon fraction, but it's just not getting at the underlying black carbon particle.
Yeah, I mean, this is Mike. I mean, the organic part, of course, is sort of unburned fuel, so it's easier to burn. You can get rid of it at, I think, lower temperatures and things. I guess I would say there's lots of kinds of particles in the atmosphere, of course, everything from natural dust, it's sort of mineral dust, to sulfate aerosols, which tend to be, when they're pretty pure and not mixed with black carbon, pretty reflective and cooling. And a lot of what is important is to look at the different kinds of particles, and there's some that tend to cool and there's some that tend to warm, and to focus on the ones that are causing the most warming are the ones that are blackest and that are not mixed with other substances. That's what's so interesting about diesel exhaust, because you pretty much burn up all the hydrocarbon, but you're left with some of the elemental carbon sort of left over, so it's very black and not doesn't get mixed with all the other substances until it gets out there and in the environment it gets mixed with it at some point, but it's still generally very dark and so very absorbent.
Are there any other responses to that? Okay. This is going to be the final call for questions. If you have any questions, please submit them at this time. You can chat them to me in the control panel located on the right-hand side of your screen. The next question is, Clean Air Task Force working with the private sector directly? If so, how? Domestically or internationally? This particular attendee joined late and wanted to know.
Sure. Clean Air Task Force, yes, we do work with the private sector. That's a pretty broad category of folks, but in the diesel space, we work with pretty much everyone in the diesel industry. We work with engine manufacturers, we work with their trade association, we work with manufacturers of the control equipment.
You don't have to turn it down.
Well,
it was fine. Even a little higher was okay.
We work with people who are involved in the supply chain so that we understand both the efficacy of the controls but also some of the challenges that are faced in terms of delivering the product to its application. We work with the diesel industry, both the construction industry and original engine manufacturers, so that we really understand the application and challenges to that they're facing with respect to both original equipment and the retrofits. So that's really important. It's been important to understand the different duty cycles of the different because engines are sold, but then people use them differently. There's many, many different duty cycles of this equipment. So understanding sort of how that interfaces with the opportunities for cleanup is important. So I think the answer is yes, we do. I think politically, probably the place that we work most closely with industry is in trying to win funding for the Diesel Emission Reduction Act. There's a very, very broad coalition of folks that doesn't just include environmentalists or the industry folks, but also governments and other affected stakeholders. But that coalition has been pretty effective through the years in trying to win reauthorization and funding for DERA.
And I believe that is all of the questions that we have for today. Do any of the presenters want to have one final word? Otherwise, we can wrap up.
Well, Liz, Mike, I would just say it's going to be very important in trying to limit climate change to go after both the long-term species and the short-lived ones. And the problem has been in international negotiations, they've sort of lumped those together. And now we're recognizing the benefits of spreading them out, of separating them out. And it's going to be important and essential to do to try and really get climate change limited over coming decades and then over coming centuries.
And do you have anything that you'd like to add to that?
Nothing additional to add, but just thank everybody for joining us today and just look for a follow-up email with some important links to ways you can get involved.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much to our panelists and to Anne, and thank you for your thoughtful questions and for attending today. We're very excited about our webinar series as it's a great way for us to connect with you, our members and supporters, on the critical issues we all care so much about. This has been the July installment of our monthly webinar series. We thank you for participating today. Please visit our website and blog for more information. You can also follow us on Twitter and Facebook to stay up to date on the latest clean energy issues. We thank you so much for joining us today. Have a lovely afternoon.